This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we're going to learn about the 400 Years Project, an effort to tell Indigenous stories more truthfully. But we are going to start today with Dan Hanaher. He is the field director for the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, the North Dakota field director. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Ashley. Nice to be here.
So we're having you on the show today to talk about what the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services has been up to, particularly since Lutheran Social Services, where you used to work, closed its door rather abruptly across the state of North Dakota. And I know you have only been at the Refugee Services Center since March of this year, but what is the role that they have filled since LSS closed its doors?
It's kind of an exciting journey that we've been on at Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service since LSS collapsed. The afternoon that we learned that the agency was going away, I immediately, as the director of New American Services, reached out to our national partner, which is LIRS, to inform them, if nothing else, that things were closing up in North Dakota, but also to ask them, is there an opportunity? Can we find a new path forward? It took a little time, but it came about, and LIRS has committed to providing the refugee services work that's necessary in North Dakota going forward. They hired me as their first employee in March. We're now a team of five, and we are providing it's rather complicated, Ashley, because it's a federal government program.
Right.
It's always complicated. But I try to explain it in that there are two buckets, and we are currently working out of the first bucket of dollars, and that's coming to us from the State Department. And it's for reception and placement of refugees. So we're doing some of the pre-work. We're alerted when an individual or a family is coming, and we begin the work of finding them a place to live, receiving them at the airport, meeting them, greeting them, doing the interpretation work that's needed, if it is needed, getting them settled into their home with basic needs, some food, some shelter, making them feel safe, and then beginning the work of getting them to the Social Security office to obtain a Social Security number because they can't be employed without that, getting them signed up for English as a second language courses, getting children enrolled in school, taking those early steps towards self-sufficiency. And that's what we're doing currently at LIRS.
Because you're working with them for the first 90 days of resettlement.
That's correct, the first 90 days. After 90 days, that work is currently being done by the state of North Dakota. The Department of Human Services absorbed staff from LSS.
Okay.
And those staff people are now providing services for what can take up to 5 years. But again, employment services, English language services, elder care, youth mentoring, just a number of initiatives, again, with the goal of self-sufficiency.
What is the distinction between a refugee, an immigrant, and an asylum seeker?
They are all immigrants. Refugees are people who receive legal status outside of the United States before entering the country. It's a long and difficult process. I understand that most refugees resettled in the United States spend anywhere from 10 to 26 years in a refugee camp. Last I heard, the average was 17 years that they're in a refugee camp. Once they're selected for consideration into the United States, they go through an extensive vetting process, both from health screening to security clearances. The FBI checks them out. Homeland Security checks them out. Counterterrorism checks them out. There is a lot of work that takes place. before these people arrive in the United States. An asylee is someone who enters the United States and requests status, legal status. And so that's the primary difference between refugees and asylees. And then there's a whole range of immigrants, people mm-hmm. who can apply for visas or green cards, come to the United States to work or go to school or visit relatives and sometimes achieve some permanent status recognition.
What is the process of just the very first step of resettlement is where in the U.S. these population groups are going to get absorbed? Now, I know Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services is headquartered in Maryland, but of course they work across the nation. How does that decision get made? Because you see, for example, in Minneapolis, there are larger populations of people from Somalia, and you have Hmong populations. But then as you go west, there's higher populations of Chinese people. They're little pockets across the country.
Yeah, and I don't have a firm grasp on some of those decisions other than that they do eventually begin settling in certain areas of the country, and that leads the State Department then to suggest, well, when we have more individuals mm-hmm. from that particular country, we will consider sending them there.
Okay.
But I'll point out that right now in North Dakota, for instance, we are only resettling people with U.S. ties. So for the most part, they're okay. coming to live with family mm-hmm. or they have very close personal relationships with people who they can come and begin their lives over with here in the United States. As our program grows, we will begin to, in the next federal fiscal year, begin accepting free cases, and those are individuals with no particular U.S. ties.
Okay.
And right now, those people that are coming here are for the most part coming from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, some Somali, we've had some Ukrainians, and Iraqis and Afghans. We really anticipate a large number of Afghans mm-hmm. in the coming months because of the U.S.'s decision to exit Afghanistan militarily. And we have so many people who have committed and worked for the United States there that they can receive special immigrant visa status. And there are upwards of, well, there, I understand there are 18,000 approximate SIVs, and then their associated family members bring it to around 70,000 possibly coming to the United States. I'm told that resettlement centers are being established in Guam that many years ago also did this process when the Vietnamese SIVs were beginning their migration to the United States. Those centers are being reestablished for the Afghans. So I think we could anticipate there will be Afghans in large numbers coming over the next few months. And they are tremendous people. I know some SIVs, and they're just wonderful people who committed themselves to the United States and are now under threat. And they deserve our care and our support.
You've mentioned some of these waves. And looking on the website of LIRS, they talk about the history of there were a number of people coming over from Western European countries after the World Wars, Eastern Europeans and Cubans in the 50s, people from Uganda and South Vietnam in the 70s. Then in the 80s, there were Asian people fathered by U.S. men, presumably as part of the Vietnam War. From the 90s, there were people from the Balkans. And then we get into the Middle East and parts of Africa like Sudan, and now you're mentioning Afghanistan. How do you start to prep for each wave of migration headed this way?
Well, we just try to always be ready for whatever confronts us.
Right, but there's language, there's religion, there's culture, there's food traditions.
Yeah, no, it's a very complex system. But the United States does it very well. I think that refugee resettlement is one of the great hidden secrets of the United States because it has enriched our country so much in terms of bringing new culture and new ways of thinking. And it has just diversified the United States so well. But you talk about these waves, and it reminds me that this is very much a process of our national security interest. Again, the Afghans that we're talking about coming, that is putting refugee resettlement in the crosshairs of the U.S. national security interests. And you can look at that across the board, going back to Vietnam, even the conflict in Bosnia during the early 90s, to relieve the pressure on a conflict zone whose bubble is bursting, relieving that pressure goes a long ways towards securing our national interests.
Dan Hanaher is the North Dakota Field Director for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Dan, how many families are you working with right now across the state?
Since LIRS began its work, we have received six cases totaling 15 individuals. The State Department indicates that by the end of September, which is the end of the federal fiscal year, we should anticipate serving 50 individuals.
And why is that need rising so dramatically?
Oh, I wouldn't say that it's rising dramatically. I think our numbers are in line with normal refugee resettlement over the years. The State Department is suggesting we plan for 250 next year. That's a modest number in terms of the numbers that North Dakota has resettled in the past.
Okay.
I believe our largest number was in excess of 700 during the George Bush administration. But it has peaks and valleys. Administrations have different policies related to this issue, and clearly the last administration was trying to curtail resettlement.
Right. There was a national cap at 15,000, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that number, in fact, will not be reached this year. There will not be 15,000 resettled this year. And just because along with COVID, the pipeline has just really narrowed. There haven't been what's called the circuit rides around the globe of State Department individuals going to refugee camps to begin that interview process. That simply did not take place for almost a year. They are beginning to take place again now. But in order for that pipeline to expand, there's some work that needs to be done. It just doesn't happen overnight.
How else did COVID impact your work?
Boy, we sure learned how to use Zoom and Teams and Skype. It was challenging, but we managed.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of the team that was at Lutheran Social Services and is now beginning its work again with LIRS, in that they were willing to take that challenge, and they perhaps took some risks at times because this work can't be done over a Zoom meeting often if you're helping to transport someone to a Social Security office. You need to do that.
But you
do it in a safe and effective manner. You make sure that people are tested. You make sure that people hopefully get vaccinated. You mask. You social distance. We've gotten it all down pretty straight.
Well, and I would imagine, too, that a family who have spent upwards of 25 years in a refugee camp and now all of a sudden they're in a new culture, a new language, new food systems, their priority isn't broadband internet.
It is and it isn't. These people, for the most part, and they're like any other subsection of the population, but I find them to be so energized, so eager, so willing to go the extra mile to advance their lives because they have a great opportunity now that's been presented to them that that they've been waiting a long time for. They didn't come here because they wanted to come here. They came here because they had no other option. They have been driven from their homes for whatever reason, whether it's ethnicity, religion, just all-out war. Now they have a new opportunity, and that's why we see so many of them so effectively starting their own businesses or working two or three or four jobs so that they can send money back to family that are still in desperate straits.
What is the percentage of people who come to you who end up employed?
I'm sorry, I don't have that exact figure, but it's significant. No, the refugee population strives to become self-sufficient, and unless there are some circumstances that stop them, whether it's medical or obviously they've all experienced some trauma, so there could be mental health issues involved, but they're up to the challenge for the most part and strive very hard to succeed, and most of them do.
The word Lutheran is right in the title, and one of the testimonials from somebody who has donated to LIRS says, "My faith tells me to welcome the stranger." Why is this an important facet of the expression of your faith?
Because it goes to who we are as human beings. I always talk about refugee resettlement with the visual of a three-legged stool, and humanitarianism is that first leg of the stool. It's for me and so many other people just very important to love your neighbor, and that's what we're trying to do. But frankly, in this current environment, humanitarianism doesn't always cut it enough. You sometimes need more of an argument. And so I'll talk about national security interests because they are real. And I'll talk about economic development and growth for a state like North Dakota that's looking for employees. It's very easy to find work in Fargo and across North Dakota today. And in fact, if we're going to continue to grow our economy, we need more people. And I don't think we're going to get there just by birthing more babies. We need other populations to come here and go to work. I think it's as simple as that. And also, they are consumers. So for those who are already running small businesses or are integral to the economy, having more purchasers is also a good thing. And then there's Social Security. I've got gray hair. A lot of us do these days. A lot of us are thinking about retirement. We need a workforce that's going to continue to contribute to Social Security. It's a very complex program when you really look at it.
What are you watching on a national level politically?
Well, just in this past week, we've seen political disruption in Haiti. We've seen marching in the streets in Cuba. The potential for those two islands to once again become hotspots for strife could also move them to consider resettling in the United States. There are a lot of debates on all sorts of issues. The southern border, while not distinctly refugee-related, is a concern because it ties to the issues that are taking place, particularly in the Northern Triangle and Colombia and Venezuela. Venezuela has experienced strife as well. Hopefully our country can work with those countries to try to end the corruption that is being exhibited currently, perhaps settle some of the strife that is being experienced in driving families out of their homes and out of their countries and looking to possibly migrate to the United States or other countries. There are always hot spots.
What about on a statewide level? What do you hope that voters keep in mind every election year?
In terms of refugees, I would hope that they would view them again as an economic empowering opportunity for the state, but as well as the humanitarian issues that obviously come to the fore when especially talking about faith and concern for fellow man. There was significant debate in the last legislative session over expanding refugee resettlement to cities outside of the Fargo, Grand Forks, and Bismarck areas. The state is considering that and looking to move to other areas of the state, which I would welcome. I think that's a wonderful opportunity if other cities are ready and prepared to welcome the stranger with the services that we may need, whether they're public transportation, English language learning in the schools. We look forward to those conversations. But I've been very grateful to the state. I feel the governor's office has been supportive of these programs, and they will continue to be, I believe. They understand the issues of the economy and national security and humanitarianism. I think refugee resettlement has a good, solid, bright future in the state.
What would you say is the single biggest need for donations for the local chapter of LIRS? Are you looking for people to open up their homes? Do you need money? Do you need shelf-stable pantry items?
Ashley, I've been at this position with LIRS not long enough to have that list of needs in front of me, but they are always there. While we have good funding from the federal government, it never goes as far as we would like it to. One of our first families arriving in May, actually on one of the hottest days of the year, were requesting blankets because they came from the Congo and now they were living in apartments with air conditioning and they weren't quite used to it. So they needed more blankets on that day. Few weeks ago when we hit 100 degrees. So there are those physical needs of material goods. Obviously, we can always use monetary donations. They help significantly, and they take us down the path of helping those families become sustainable on their own. But more than anything, I think what we would like to see from the community is that warm embrace that we almost always get.
Dan Hanaher is the North Dakota Field Director for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Thanks so much for your time today.
Ashley, thanks for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, we learn about the 400 Years Project. But now, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The chairman of the legislature's Interim Education Policy Committee says over the past few years, the legislature has worked to change policies to allow local school districts to be more innovative in how they provide education. Bismarck Democratic State Senator Erin Oban says in this biennium, her committee will hear from the districts themselves to find out the effects of those changes.
Which districts are taking advantage of it, and has it changed any outcomes for kids or for recruiting and retaining educators?
Oban says the committee will also look at how districts fared with online education brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic.
I think we all have to have a little grace on how that year went and understand that it was a challenge for kids. It was a challenge for educators who very quickly switched gears and did the best they could with that situation. But from my perspective, I think if we look at those numbers that come out of that year with a little grace because of what happened, we just need to move forward and understand that, you know, kids are resilient, but we want them in a classroom safely as much as possible.
Oban says she knows some children might need to catch up a little bit because of not being face-to-face in a classroom. It may seem like common sense to water your lawn and plants a bit more during times of extreme drought, but horticulturists caution against that. Esther McGinnis is an extension horticulturist with NDSU Extension as well as director of the Extension Master Garden Program. She says overacting to overly dry conditions is a common mistake, but there are simple steps you can take to prevent overwatering your plants. McGinnis says knowing the type of soil your plants are growing in is important. Sandy soils dry out faster and require more moisture, while clay soils retain more water. She also says what can be tricky is that an overwatered plant can wilt, just like a plant that needs watering.
There is one little trick to tell the difference between an underwatered versus an overwatered plant. An underwatered plant, we may see that the leaves start to brown on the margins of the leaves and turn crispy. And you won't necessarily see that on an overwatered plant.
McGinnis says most plants only need around an inch or an inch and a half of water per week during the week, and usually only once or twice a week. And for the 12th time since the first Fargo Air Show in 1989, the Navy's Blue Angels will be the headliner both Saturday and Sunday. Air Show co-chair Dick Walstead says the Precision Flying Team will announce their arrival early Wednesday afternoon in the newest version of the F-18.
The F-18 Hornet, but this is a Super Hornet. It has all kinds of more power and more maneuverability and more noise, and we're going to hear about it.
The commander this year is Fargo South High School and Concordia College graduate Brian Kesserling, who attended the show as a child. Practice flights in and around Fargo-Moorhead will take place on Thursday and Friday with a closed practice at Hector International Airport Friday afternoon. That is not open to the public. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Early automobile trails in America included the 1914 Red Trail that extended from Seattle to New York City. The Red Trail became Highway 10 in 1927. And today, you can still drive a section of that original route in the Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson. You can enjoy a pastoral country drive and the small-town amenities in New Salem, Almont, Glen Ullin, Hebron, and Richardton. More information about the Old Red Trail can be found online at oldredold10.com or on their Facebook page. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2021 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2021 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Sheena Brings Plenty. She is the co-founder of the 400 Years Project. Sheena, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. We appreciate you having us on and being here. I appreciate it.
What is the 400 Years Project?
So we are a photography collective that looks at the rights, representation, and identity of Native people through photography and in the 400 years since the landing of the Mayflower. We have several different parts to our project, from photo essays and texts to a Native photographer library. And our goal is really to center the Native voice through photography.
And why photography?
Well, two of our co-founders, Brian Adams and Sarah Stack, are both photographers. I am married to a photographer, so for the three of
okay.
us, it's a passion thing. But also, it's something that Native people have sort of been left out of the narrative in. When you look at especially historic photographs of Native people, mm-hmm. they're generally done by non-Native people, and the narrative and the stories and the of it has sort of been done sans American Indians. And so, what we want to create is sort of adding to that narrative, but with the Native voice worked in there as well as everybody else, to create a kind of a more equitable rounded out story.
Right, because so often these photos that we see, they're very much locked in time. Coming from my perspective as a white person, all of the photos that we ever saw of indigenous peoples in history books were just this locked in time, almost as if there a was, not an are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of times they were misrepresented. If you look at, I think Edward S. Curtis is one of the most prime examples of natives in photography. And a lot of his photos are different native people, potentially from different tribes, wearing the exact same native style put together outfits, you know. And so the representation of native people was not put out there honestly. It was put out there in a very different way, sans native people. And right. So, you know, for us, we really want to help to fill in that archive, you know, and create a contemporary archive of native photography by native people, of native people, and the things that have happened in the past and to now, to create that full narrative.
Right. And I'm just thinking, all wearing the same kind of regalia, when even now there are 573, I believe, federally recognized tribes and pueblos. And prior to colonization, those people groups, a much bigger number. And then here, all stuck in the same outfit as if they're just one perspective that could be considered
exactly.
At all. I'm wondering why 400 years? Because certainly indigenous peoples have been around tens of thousands of years if you look at the archaeological record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so for us, 400 years obviously comes from the landing of the Mayflower was 400 years ago from 2020. That's when we started. It was in September of 2020.
Okay.
And November 2020 was the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower here in North America. And obviously, Native people were here, you know, thousands of years before that. I live on the homelands of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina, and their history has been archaeologically documented to be more than 14,000 years of inhabitants on this land. And so when you look at 14,000 plus years of Native inhabitants, and then you look at our short 400 years, the reason that we went for the 400 years is because at that moment is when life and everything changed for Native people in that moment at the landing of the Mayflower 400 years ago. And so, you know, our viewpoint of Native people and the story and the histories and everything of Native people were dramatically changed from that moment on. So that's where we landed with the 400 years, because obviously Native people had come in contact with Nordic people before that. You know, there were Native people that came in contact with, you know, DeSoto and his groups even before that. And, you know, so, but the Mayflower, the landing of the Mayflower is sort of the beginning of the contemporary history of Native people in North America. And that's where we wanted to start.
Yeah. And from the perspective of the dominant culture, that story starts at the Mayflower came over. There was a land of barely inhabited savages that we civilized, and then we broke bread together and had Thanksgiving. Whew, how much of that would you like to correct?
All of it.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, that myth, and that's exactly what it is a myth. We've all been told in school and, you know, through the narrative that when the Mayflower arrived, the Native inhabitants just very friendly, like, moved over and everything was fine. And that's really not at all what happened. And so the Native side of that story needs to be told. And that's what we're trying to do with the 400 Years Project, is create that narrative and the Native side of that narrative so that the story is complete.
Right. Not only was it not really hunky-dory, it was a massacre, for sure, among the Wampanoag people, but certainly other groups that were then in the eastern parts of the U.S.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are several tribes that were historically documented that are now extinct. I mean, and when you think about that in what is still modern-ish history, you know, the only the last 400 years that you have a entire groups of people that are extinct. I mean, and that is a very big plot point to leave out of the story of the landing of the Europeans and the colonization of this country and native people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to fill in with the 400 Years Project, is to look at Native rights and Native identity and Native representation through the camera lens. What does that mean to Indigenous or Native people of North America? Because we do have photographers from Canada, from the United States, some from Mexico, and then one from Greenland, who all share the same history of that nation, you know, and the effects of colonization.
And I noticed that there was some special attention on the website, and it's 400yearsproject.org. The appointment of Secretary Deb Holland, Puebla of Laguna. She is the first Native woman to have a secretary-level cabinet position and only the second Indigenous person in the cabinet at all. That's a very small number. But I'm just wondering, does that kind of representation on a federal level, even a small number, even after 400 years, is that cause for hope?
I think it definitely is. We, you know, with Secretary Holland being appointed and being confirmed, I mean, that was a huge step forward for Native people, because it's never happened before, you know, and to finally be at a point to where at the table, not just in the background, not just, you know, said, oh, well, Native people used to exist, but they don't anymore. I mean, to be seen and heard and have a position of authority, but also a position to where Native people can have a voice and some action in what is happening on Native lands, especially. I mean, the fact that she was, you know, became the secretary, that's huge for Native people. But it's also huge because it shows that, you know, how long it's taken for Native people to be at the table. You know, we're talking about 400 years of Native people being here and existing and being tribes, but also not having as much of a voice as other people. So it's gone a long way, I think, toward inspiring other other people as well to see that what you can achieve now as a Native person being allowed to be at the table, you know, where in, you know, 1924 was when Native people became citizens of the United States. I mean, so, you know, we're not even talking
That's
about 100
when
years
my grandpa
yet
was
of
born.
Yeah, exactly. We're not even talking about, I mean, we haven't even reached 100 years of citizenship. And so, you know, to be able to be at the table and to have those discussions and have Native voices be heard and seen is gigantic. And Deb Holland, you know, becoming the secretary was ginormous for Native people. And on our website, we did do a special project section of a few of our photographers were taking photos of their communities when on the day that Deb Holland was confirmed. So that was, it was just sort of a neat viewpoint of what was happening in Native communities while we were all waiting for this big confirmation.
Right. And as you mentioned, as Secretary of the Interior, she has direct oversight of land in this country. And, you know, recently there have been some attempts to scale back protections around some sacred places like Bears Ears Monuments and Grand Staircase Escalante. I have also noticed lately meetings that have started with, we recognize that we are standing on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe people. And even you said you live on the traditional homelands of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and you yourself are Winnebago, Irish, and Norwegian. Why is it important that we say that?
Well, I think it's important for several reasons. One, it goes back to the narrative of our country. And, you know, it needs to be told and told properly that Native people were here and are still here. And so just because the land was stolen or apportioned, you know, divvied up, or however you want to say it, and whatever the circumstances were, there were people who were on that land and whose land that was prior to colonization. And for me, as a person who is not a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, but is living on the reservation lands and the homelands of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, it's important for me to recognize and remember that I'm a guest in their community. And I think it's important for others as well to act accordingly to that mentality that we are guests on the homelands of other people. And same thing as on a small scale, if you were to go to a friend's house and, you know, you wouldn't act a fool, essentially, as my mom used to say. you would act accordingly as being a guest. You would act respectfully. You would be helpful. You would be kind. You would be courteous. And I think that that is where the reason that we need to be acknowledging whose land we're on, because we need to remember that we are guests of the land of the people that lived here before, who were not with respect, who were not treated with courtesy, who in fact were in a lot of instances and most instances treated very harshly and, you know, killed for something as simple as land. So I think it's important for people to realize exactly why and how they came to be on the land that is now considered United States property, or, you know, whatever state or federal property it might be. But I think that's the reason it's important. And I love seeing that. I think it's one of the greatest things that has come about in the last year is people giving that acknowledgement to the original inhabitants of this country.
Yeah, thank you for that, because I kind of wondered about that line between lip service and action there. But that recognition, that makes sense. You wouldn't do this at a guest's house. How did the pandemic impact this project? And that's, I'm sure, an obnoxiously huge question.
No, it's actually not. I think the pandemic, you know, it was such a huge thing and is still such a huge thing for our world. And it's the one thing that kind of has brought us all to the same point. So there's a lot of connection that has happened there while we've been disconnected, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. For us with 400 years, it required us to be a lot more creative, like most people, in how we were going to build something in the year 2020 that we were just starting. And so we had to be a lot more creative about finding photographers and creating relationships with people on a personal level to be able to create the library and to create this project that is it's massive. It's a big undertaking. And so we relied heavily on Zoom and phone calls and social media. Social media was huge for us. Particularly Instagram was huge for us to be able to connect with people and connect with photographers and connect with, people in the world, but across the country and across North America, who have the same kind of common goals that we have and common ideals that we have. So the pandemic made us just be a little more creative, but luckily we're creative people.
Right.
So, yeah.
Opens up new channels in the brain, right?
Right, exactly.
What's been the reaction to the project?
The reaction has been wonderful. We've seen a lot of interest on our social media pages growing. Our Instagram in particular has almost 3,200 followers, which is huge for any small project that's only been going just a few months. We've had, you know, lots of photographers and non-photographers alike from multi you know, from all different areas and all different backgrounds and all different nationalities, following our project and engaging and sharing. So that's been really exciting, just to be kind of accepted in the larger photography community. We've also had a lot of gestures of support since our launching in September, or starting in September and launching in November with our website. We've been invited to speak at universities, both here in the States and in Canada. We have spoken at photography summits, which are great, great, great places, you know, where lots of photographers from all different backgrounds come together. And then we've also been contacted by people and organizations who are interested in archives, who are interested in what we're doing, and who are using us as a resource for other, to find other other Native projects or people or information. There was a person who contacted us just recently who was asking for real, true Native resources to find Native art. And then we've received donations. If anybody is interested in donating to our project, you can go to 400yearsproject.org, scroll all the way to the bottom, and we do accept donations to help us pay for photographers and photo stories and essays. So,
what do you hope is the future of this project?
For us, we want to engage as many people as possible and really get the information out there that the Native story, the Native side of the narrative, since the landing of the Mayflower, is here, and it is centralized, and it is important to know. But also, we want to be a hub and an archive going forward, sort of a contemporary archive for Native photographers. In national archives, it's really, really hard to find Native photographers because they're usually not listed by ethnicity. Mm. And so, again, Native photographers end up being left out of the conversation a lot of times. And so we, as we grow, we want to, you know, offer as many opportunities to our Native photographers and allies as we can. We hope to, you know, continue to grow the library portion, which is 100% Native, all Native photographers from amateurs and enthusiasts all the way up to complete professionals, you know, and everywhere in between. And just really allow Native people through their lens to tell their stories, to share their history, to talk about things that are important to them, and to really reach that wider audience.
And you can look at all of the photos and read some of the text from the photo essays at 400yearsproject.org. Sheena Brings Plenty is one of the co-founders of the project. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. We are spotlighting the contributions of Southern European immigrants to the culinary landscape of the American Midwest. We are focusing on the old world influences of Italian and Greek communities.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 20th. On this date in 1932, five Prohibition agents raided the largest still west of Chicago. It was on a farm 5 miles north of Jamestown. Special agents had suspected a still in the Jamestown vicinity since the 1st of July, when a truckload of corn sugar, which is the main ingredient of homemade moonshine, was tracked from Valley City to near Jamestown, where they lost the trail. Soon after, agents followed a truckload of piping from Fargo. Again, they lost the trail near Jamestown. Agents scoured the area for weeks and began to suspect a farm nestled in the wooded hills between Highways 20 and 281. It was in a picturesque spot, and its location between the two heavily traveled highways made it ideal for bootlegging. The agents hit the farmyard at 3 a.m. on July 20th to discover a gigantic moonshine operation in two former hog sheds. 12-foot-high boilers were steaming hot, but there was no one in sight. Agents determined that 6 to 8 men were involved in the operation and that they lived in the farmhouse. In one of the bedrooms, they discovered a buzzer, an advance warning system linked to the sheds. The operation turned out to be larger than anyone expected, capable of producing 1,000 gallons of liquor a day. It was quickly coined the largest still west of Chicago. The still could hold 3,000 gallons, and it was nearly full when discovered. 12 redwood vats were also found. The vats held 100,000 gallons of mash, a mixture of water, sugar, and yeast that creates the alcohol. Agents estimated that the still had been operating a mere 8 days, but it had been efficient. In the rafters of the hog sheds, they found 2,500 gallons of moonshine. Oscar Seiler owned the farm, but he'd been living in California for at least 4 years. Upon learning of the raid, Seiler immediately came back to check on his property. Seiler had rented the farm to Frank Bronk, who, along with another man, was arrested. While an investigation took place, 9 men demolished the still, a process viewed by hundreds of onlookers. 3 large holes were dug and then filled with thousands of gallons of liquor and mash. The site of the largest still west of Chicago can no longer be seen. It's now covered by the Jamestown Reservoir. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas, filling in for Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
U.S. troops are leaving Afghanistan, and some people who fought in America's longest war are wondering why they were there.
It was about 9/11, but at this point, I don't really know what it's about.
And the families of fallen soldiers struggle to move forward.
Fathers aren't supposed to bury children. There is no closure for that.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, have you fallen behind on rent because of the pandemic? There is money available to help, and we are going to learn about who qualifies with Carmel Fromke with the Community Action Partnership of North Dakota. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.